we could turn to the origins of the Pittsburgh Conference and its earliest years, and can you talk literally about the origins for them?
Yes. Well, it really goes back to the fact that there were two active organizations here. They both started in the 40s. The older one is the Spectroscopy Society of Pittsburgh, which was an outgrowth of some seminars that Mary Warga at Pitt had organized. She was an emissions spectroscopist, performed a very valuable service during the war by training lots of atomic spectroscopists who worked in the various mills around Pittsburgh. And they had regular or periodic meetings, at least. And finally they organized, I think it was perhaps around 1946, but I'm not sure about that, into the society. Then that had an annual meeting. The other group was the Society of Analytical Chemists of Pittsburgh. They were some analytical chemists that started meeting in one another's homes because they felt that the local ACS section didn't quite meet their needs. For example, it wasn't as social as these other meetings. And they too organized, and they had annual meetings. And in 1950, the two groups decided they would combine their meetings, and that was the first of the Pittsburgh conferences.
What was the employment base that led to there being so many people interested?
The heavy metal industry, the steel mills, the aluminum company up here, and then to a lesser extent, and not metals, companies like Gulf Oil and Copper's Corporation. But there was a big demand for analytical spectroscopy. For example, you know, an order of steel is placed by, say, an automobile company. They will specify a certain composition for the steel, so much manganese, so much vanadium, and so on. And so this mixture, it's kept molten in an open hearth furnace, and they have to sample it. And then they will add maybe a little more manganese ore to bring that amount up. But they need a number of quantitative analyses. When this were done by wet chemistry, it was a slow process, and it cost them real money to keep that furnace full of molten steel till they got the composition right. So that's when they started using spectroscopy.
Do you know anything about how that was driven? Because large, well-established, older corporations aren't necessarily innovative in technique.
I don't know how that happened in the steel industry. In the aluminum industry, it was the outgrowth of H.V. Churchill, who was in their research lab, and he was keenly aware of the need for these rapid analyses, and he was instrumental in having the so-called direct readers developed. Now, he didn't do it himself. This was done by people like Hassler in the West Coast. In the steel industry, I don't know who it was behind it, but I know that by the time I got here in 48, this was a widely used practice. You might be interested in knowing how they did it. They had evacuated glass tubes about maybe 4 to 6 inches long. Those were held in a pair of tongs out over the molten bath and then lowered to the surface, and the glass melted, and the a sample of the ore was of the melt was sucked up into the tube, and then it solidified there. So then they take that and throw it in a bucket of water, the glass would crack off, and they had a metal rod. This was then sent by a pneumatic tube to the spectrograph. There was a man who would saw the thing in two, so they have a fresh, clean cut, and he would mount it in the spark holder. The spectrograph was built in a dark room, and there would be a man in there who would change the film and take the exposures. So the first man who was outside would mount it in the spark holder and start a spark. The man inside would take a photograph of it, and then this photograph would be developed. There would be a series of exposures on it, usually by some kind of a step sector arrangement. But they would take the photograph, and then the third man would develop it, and they would densitometer it. Well, densitometering is not a very satisfactory process. So in time, they developed direct readers for these two, which the receivers were some kind of a electron capture device that was mounted right at the slits where the lines for each of the elements you're interested in would come out of the spectrograph. And so that way they could get a sample very quickly and know what the analysis was, and then doctor up the composition of the mix. So they cut the holding time down dramatically by doing this. So although it cost the money to put in this gear and hire these people, they've saved money many times over that.
Go back into the Pittsburgh Conference.
All right, Pittsburgh Conference. So the two organizations decided to combine their meeting in 1950. And somebody had the brilliant idea of having an instrument exhibit at the same time. And that was a stroke of fortune, good fortune, because the instrument exhibit has been a very important component ever since. So the first meeting was held, and because it had been traditional for one of these groups to meet around the end of February, that's when they had the first meeting. And it's been traditional to hold the meeting in early March ever since then. And it was a very unfortunate choice. They should have picked a time when the weather was better. At that stage, they could have done it. To change now, it would be almost impossible because convention centers have lined up their dates so far in advance that you can scarcely move a big meeting like PIPCON. We would interfere with the ACS fall meeting and the FACS and Eastern Analytical Symposium and so on. But that meeting was held in Pittsburgh, and it stayed in Pittsburgh. It pleased everybody that the attendance was so good. As I recall, it was something like 800. And so they decided to have it the next year, and then the next year, and so on.
You yourself were actively engaged with that first one?
I was at the first one, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't remember whether I had a role in anyway. I very quickly got into the program committee, but I'm not sure which year that was. We had come here in the summer of 48, and I went to a couple of the society meetings. I'm sure I went to the spectroscopy one in 49, and I think I went to the SACP one in 49, and then I was certainly at the other. It was held on the 17th floor used to be called the Penn Sheridan. What's it now?
William Penn,
something or other. Yeah. There are a couple interesting stories. I think you may have heard these about how the elevator was, let's say, 16 feet high, and they had a carton that was 17 feet long. How do you get it up? Well, you lean it on its side in the elevator. But then there was another one that was too long to do that, and it was put on top of the elevator car. And I talked with somebody who rode up with it. He was on top to see that it didn't fall off.
Oh, my
goodness. Oh, wouldn't that be something? And then on one occasion, Perkin-Elmer didn't get a crate back after the conference, and they called the hotel. No, there was no crate left here. But several years later, they got a call from the hotel saying they had found a crate in the basement of an elevator shaft when they were overhauling an elevator. Did it belong to them? It had the company name on the side. That was it. How it got down there, nobody knows, and probably you should know knows. And why it wasn't smashed, I have no idea. But it's amazing to think it could be down there.
Was there in Fisher Scientific was in Pittsburgh. Were there other companies? Other companies.
Yes, there was Burrell Scientific was another one, and there may have been some others. Fisher was a big supporter of the conference. That is, the first meeting they had, let's say, three booths, but most companies have one. And it was a good arrangement for any of the exhibitors, of course. There was another company, they made gas analysis equipment, started with B. What was that? Maybe that was Burrell. So there was some local support.
Was Chester Fisher visible in local scientific circles?
Yes, but before that. I never saw him, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. Before that, through the war, he was very active and would go to ACS meetings and so on. But he had tapered off and maybe had died, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. by the time I got here.
There were the three sons, I think.
There were sons.
Were they visible? Or?
Not very. I knew Jim a slight bit, but they really didn't take part in the scientific side of things that I would have.
In that starting era, I mean, infrared was very, very important. What else was it all about? Or was it mainly infrared?
The program was really in two parts. One was atomic emission spectroscopy, and the other was wet chemistry. And infrared was a small sideline along that. It's changed almost completely. Those two subjects now are a very small part of the conference. And as you go through the years, you find the emphasis has changed. And gas chromatography came in. That was a big thing. And then other kinds of chromatography, and then clinical chemistry, and now various aspects of biochemistry or molecular biology and that sort of thing are big. So it mirrors what the general research interests are in as far as they impinge on analytical chemistry.
There's now a very sort of very sophisticated volunteer structure that carries memory forward, as it were,
yes.
In various ways. Was the development of that structure a matter of fierce contest from time to time? Or?
No. It started very early, but there was never any doubt that it was a good idea, as far as I'm aware. There are two aspects of it. First of all, every chairman was to write a lengthy report on the activities of his committee, with such things as timelines, addresses of people you should be in touch with, and things that went well, things that didn't go well and should be thought about for the future. Then each committee had a chairman elect, and the chairman was to keep that person thoroughly informed of what was going on and what was being done, send him copies of all correspondence, for example, so that that person would be well prepared to take over the following year. And between these two things, a big body of knowledge was accumulated, and experience, which was then passed down from one year to the other, and very important.
Is it? It's surprising. I mean, the Pittsburgh Conference is a very surprising thing, and it's surprising that the chemistry and instrumentation community in Pittsburgh has been able to sustain it.
Yes.
Is that two things? One is that community must have changed a great deal over the years. In what way has that community changed?
We went through a period when a number of large laboratories disappeared. The Westinghouse Research Laboratory, which used to have 2,400 people in it, and they always had some people that were active in PittCon. Gulf Oil disappeared. The Copper's Corporation Lab disappeared. U.S. Steel was cut way back. This meant that the number of potential committee people, the pool was reduced a lot. Now, this has been partly made up by new companies and growth of some other ones. Pittsburgh Plate Glass, PPG Labs, have grown a great deal. The Bayer Labs are relatively new, so that brought in a new pool of people, and that helped. But this has become a serious problem. And another thing is that the jobs are taking a lot of time now, especially the chairman, a great deal of time. And so people are more reluctant to take it on. Then there's another thing. The companies in town used to take great pride in having their people involved in something like this. And they would rather freely give them time to do it, and often secretarial help and that sort of thing. Now, with the current economy and the sharp eye on the bottom line, that's more difficult. Lots of people have to take personal vacation to go to PITCON, even if they're an officer in it. And this has been a serious concern. Another thing is that the people who started the conference are pretty much sitting out right now. There are only a few of us who were there the first year that are left. And so we have to keep getting a new pool of younger people. That's pretty obvious. Fortunately, I think they've done quite well with that. We've had some very good additions in the last 10 years or so. So I'd say we're holding our own. It's a steady state, but it's a matter of considerable concern to them. I'll mention one other thing in passing. Pittsburgh is one of the few cities in the country where PITCON could have gotten started. It had a big pool of people interested in the subject and working in the field. It had these two societies, and they had a track record of holding their own meetings. And so that the conditions were right here. And I suspect there aren't very many other cities in the country which could have met those requirements.
People like yourself, I mean, have some people have stayed engaged over very long periods of time.
Right.
And the structure essentially can accommodate that.
Yes. Yes. They make provision for keeping on the old timers in some way or another. If I wanted, I could still be very active on the program committee. I just felt I was not with it very much anymore, and that should give somebody else who would be better at it that should have a chance.
What is the role of that program committee? Is it simply a traffic manager, or is it more than that?
No, it's more than that. When we started, we used to dream up our own invited speakers, and then later on invited symposia. They originated from the program committee. You got to be too large to do that. So now they invite suggestions from attendees as well as committee members for invited speakers, and particularly for symposium topics. They ask people to submit a list, a proposed symposium, with a list of potential speakers and the subjects they would deal on. Now, the program committee takes this list. We had a meeting a month or so ago. They take all of these suggestions that come in, and they winnow them down to a manageable number. And so in that sense, I guess you'd say it's a traffic control system. The other thing we do is then we have the job of arranging all the contributed papers in sessions. That's a huge job. And then there's a meeting in which we decide what days of the week each of these things is going to take place. And you have to look and see that you don't get two gas chromatography sections the same half day or things like that. But it's quite a complicated business. The program committee chairman has a big job.
Now, is there a formal or informal structure of succession that is, you become the program committee chair, then you head up
no,
to becoming...
No, there's nothing formal on that. It varies. The person who is going to be the chairman for a given year appoints the committee chairman for that year, and that's done at least 2 years in advance. So, for example, if I were to be chairman next year, I would have appointed the person who is going to be program chairman, and that person will be assistant program chairman this year, so that that's a year of training. But there's no guarantee that from the program you'll go to be treasurer or you'll be in charge of housing or anything else. That's random. Each president-elect, and we are 3 years in advance. It was this year, next year, and the following year. Each of them pick their own chairman.
If you look over the, it really goes back before the Pittsburgh Conference, go back into the 30s, I guess, and say changes in analytical instrumentation. What do you see as the big changes over time?
The big change, I think, is the application of electronics. From the 30s, and I guess the next big one would be the application of computers.
But which I think really began in earnest when?
Oh, maybe 1980, 85 to be really big. But I think the important one was the switch to electronics.
Both of those things are, at least initially, simply enablers of something that already exists.
Yes.
And within the different categories and genres of analytical instrumentation, you said a little while ago, gas chromatography.
Chromatography in all its forms.
If you were to sort of characterize almost by decade as to what's hot,
yeah,
how would that go?
Well, I'd say in the late 40s and 50s, it would have been the advent of infrared and maybe mass spec at that time. Then chromatography, didn't that come in about 62 or so?
I think so.
I'm all hazy on this now.
Somewhere around there, because when I was coming into the field, it was very hot.
Very hot. But of course, the various forms of that came in over a period of 10 or 12 years, paper chromatography and the gas chromatography and then liquid and so on. Then, after that, of course, then with each of these, some other areas died out.
What has dwindled, if you...
Mass spec, wet chemistry is, I guess, the main one. Emission spectroscopy took a big nosedive, but it's coming back a little bit. Quite a little bit. For example, the advent of ICP has revitalized it. Yeah, wet chemistry is probably the main sufferer. Mass spectra is not as important as it used to be. And, now wait a minute, I take that back. Let me change that to microwave. One time I was thought microwave might be pretty useful, but it hasn't turned out to be that way. NMR has never caught on at VidCon. Been a little disappointing to some of us. They have their own meeting, and it comes pretty close to VidCon time, I believe.
There's been a huge increase, especially in the very recent past, in the sort of life sciences territories, and I guess PIPCOM both hasn't been in those territories in some way.
Well, they're trying hard. They're making a big push now to do that, because it's thought that this is a very promising area of a new area for analytical methods.
Is that what's the obvious competition for that?
I don't know. There are some molecular biology type meetings, but I don't know what they are. I know I've sat in on a big discussion in one of the program committee meetings about what to do about this, and they are going around, you know, they PIPCON exhibits at various other meetings and trying to publicize the program, and they went to one and they found these people totally unaware of PIPCON and what it's all about. Now, you'll find in next year's program, for example, there will be several invited symposia, half-day symposia on different topics of that sort.
Mm-hmm. What apart from the sheer growth in size, what is it that you notice about change in PIPCON?
Well, I think what I know is it's all tied to size. Just, you can't hear everything you want to hear, you can't see anything, everything you want to see. I think that, I remember if you walk around the exhibit, spend 1 minute per exhibit, you can't see more than about three quarters of it in the full time the exhibit's opened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just impossible to, you know, it's therefore harder to browse, like the literature in that respect. What else? Well, we have, because of size, we have fewer cities that are possible sites to go.
Has that size in the conference affected the core group who run it?
No, I don't think so. It's my feeling that we're just about leveled off on size. I don't think we're going to have significant growth. But this year, you know, it dropped back 5,000, mm-hmm. which I think is a reflection of the poor economy.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the exhibitors, as I hear it, didn't feel badly about that. It was apparently the people that went were the people that had the authority to place orders, and they're the ones that count.
Yes.
And the ones that didn't come were the lower level people.
Just looking,
yes. Or being educated, maybe, for the papers, but their company wasn't underwriting them this year.
If we go back to infrared and Raman spectroscopy, how are those fields themselves faring and changing?
Let's take Raman first. I think that's easier. I think it's booming. And a while ago we were talking about changes in the technology. Of course, the advent of the laser was an enormous one too, which had a big impact on Raman spectroscopy. But there are other things like array detectors have been very important. So I think that's doing very well. Infrared is, I would say, treading water now. There haven't been any really big changes since the advent of Fourier transform techniques. The next big one that I foresee is a tunable infrared laser, so you can get rid of all the spectrometer and have lots of power. That would be another giant step forward. But when it will arrive, I don't know. What time do you do
a.m.
6:30?
Yes,
we better
keep an eye.
I think we better stop.
Let me just ask you two, three things. One is, if you think about individuals and instrument entrepreneurs and inventive genius in those fields, Arnold Beckman is one obvious name. What other names would you put up on the screen?
Howard Carey, Howard Malmsteen.
Although he wasn't an instrumental one, I think A.J. Pete Martin certainly got two very important fields going.
Two?
Well, two kinds of chromatography.
Okay, yes.
Paper chromatography, yeah.